Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your spring-like podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. My name is Ned Bolting.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And I'm Laura Laker.
This week, and without any further ado, I want to introduce our special guest, because I know that behind the scenes, Adam and Laura have spent a while trying to set this up. We're very, very pleased to be able to introduce Walking and Cycling Commissioner for London, Dr. Will Norman. Now, I'm sure many of you will know exactly who Will is and what he does, but for those of you who don't, Will was appointed 4 years ago with the task of trebling the length of cycleways delivered by his predecessor. And he also has walking in his title, unlike Andrew Gilligan, who was his predecessor. Now, we thought things were emotionally fraught around active travel back then when protesters over CS11 had turned the conversation, quote, uncivil. Little did we know quite where we'd find ourselves now. So I guess my first question to you, Will, before I sort of leave the floor open to Adam and Laura, is how are you amidst all this febrile atmosphere in which we find ourselves, and how are you navigating it all?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on. It's a good question. How am I? I'm shattered. It's been a difficult year for everybody. You know, this has been exhausting, whatever anyone does. But I think, as you said, you know, the sort of the world of active travel has never been more important. And the amount of stuff that's been going on in London has been nothing short of phenomenal. But with that, you always get, you know, you get a backlash, and there are, you know, I think the scale and the pace of everything that's been delivered just has meant that the sort of the scale of the backlash has been proportional to that. And, you know, I think you're right, not all of it has been civil, and that can be draining at times.
Is it something where when you started this job, obviously no one was able to predict the situation we got into with COVID and the pandemic, of course, but obviously it's a public role. It's quite high profile. Did you think it would be like this, or is this off the scale? Because you've been thrusted into a very public position because of how important active travel is at the moment and how integral your role is to delivering it.
Yeah. It seems a long time ago since I started this job, and I think my grey hairs that I'm not sure your listeners can see account for certainly how I felt. You know, the time has been ups and downs that time. Laura wrote an article when I first started, and the headline in The Guardian was,
I was going to mention this.
This guy's too nice to do his job. And at which point, I can't remember it, but essentially all my friends then started texting me fake news. Will Norman is not a nice guy. But I think coming into the job, I hadn't really, you know, I knew that it would be a challenge. I took the job because it was a challenge and it was something I believed in, but I hadn't really quite realized just when you start delivering how, you know, how heightened, how much heightened emotion there is on both sides. And that's both from people who oppose things, but also who don't want to see cyclings, but also for cyclists who want to see more and they want to see it better and they want to see it faster. And so that, that sort of that public role, I think, was, it wasn't a complete shock, but the sort of the intensity of it, I think, came as a bit of a shock. And it's something that I've sort of, you know, I think I've learned to get on with.
Just in pure practical terms, Will, about the kind of nuts and bolts and the detail of your job. As you say, you know, it's been a few years now since you've been in the role. What, you know, leaving aside the kind of like all the fluff that goes up, not fluff, that's totally the wrong word, but the context that you've just mentioned around the debate, what has your opinion about what is desirable, achievable, changed? You know, have you actually learned about this mammoth task that is kind of, you know, the active travel revolution? And if so, what would the key lessons there be?
Oh, yeah, without a shadow of doubt, I think I've learned an astonishing amount. And anyone who's been with me in any part of the journey, I think if you track back through my various quotes and tweets, you can see that I've been learning as we go along. And hopefully I've been getting better at it. I think, you know, the job itself has changed. You know, we started off, you know, setting out a strategy, setting out a plan, how we deliver it, learning from what works, what doesn't. You know, for me, and particularly in the last year, it's gone to show just actually we can deliver a huge amount and we can do it quickly and we can do it well. But that takes more than, you know, that takes an awful lot of people. And it's all what's happened in London over the past year or so, I think, is all credit to the amazing teams that are out there, both in TfL and in the boroughs. You can't just rock up at the Olympics and expect to compete in the and deliver your best performance in the 100-meter sprint, having not done any training. And I think that for the first four years of this administration, we were delivering record amounts, and we did meet that target to triple the amount of protected cycle lanes, which I think quite a lot of people, including the people who set us that target, didn't think we would do. But we achieved that. But because of the skill and the experience of everybody who helped achieve that, they then just, you know, they were able to really accelerate and do innovative things in a very different scale and pace during the COVID crisis that has seen this huge boom in cycling across the capital.
It was funny that you mentioned that article. I had a look at that just this afternoon, actually. And it's amazing looking back how much things have changed and the kind of ambition that you had back then for stuff. And I was chuckling, perhaps slightly sadly. Have you still got it?
I've still got it, I think. I think my mum sent it to me.
He's got it was actually in print. I didn't realise it went in print, actually. It's quite interesting looking back, because it was like Oxford Street pedestrianisation, which hasn't happened. There was like CS11, which hasn't happened. King's Cross gyratory, still horrible. We've got Lambeth Bridge North, which is still like super lethal.
Lambeth Bridge North isn't super lethal at the moment because it's got the temporary scheme in, but the south, I would agree with you on that.
It's got some stuff, yeah. Euston Road, Waterloo IMAX. Yeah, there's still quite a lot that kind of didn't get done, but then kind of stuff that kind of replaced it.
Part of the learning on, you know, when I came into the job, there were these schemes that you would just sort of pursue relentlessly. You know, CS11, I think, is a good example of that, or Oxford Street, where we sort of say, we're going to do this, yeah? And then we're just going to carry on pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing until we do it. And it didn't work. You know, it just didn't work, particularly those two schemes I call out in particular. And, you know, what I took away from that is that actually to deliver some the scale that we need across the city, and we all recognise we need a really integrated cycle network. You know, I think our plans for something like 1,400 kilometres, 1,400 kilometres across the city. To do that, and if you're getting stuck on 1 kilometre of that, yeah, you could devote all your energies onto that bit where you're stuck. But there are plenty of other schemes. There are plenty of other areas across the city where the infrastructure is needed. So the shift that happened, certainly in my head, was that we need a pipeline of this stuff. Yeah, We need to be able to sort of over-program for what we want to deliver, so that if something is not working, if there's political objections to that, as there was with Cycle Highway 11 from Westminster, if we come across those barriers and it's getting to the point where actually, is this the best use of all our time and resources, then we need to, and it's not working, let's shift to something else, which is deliverable. And I think that that approach has helped us deliver all that we have done in this term. There are, as you said, loads of things that we still haven't delivered and we need to deliver. Those junctions, I still want to, Swiss Cottage is still a horrendous space for pedestrians and for cyclists, and we need to get that right. Regent's Park, you've still got cars zooming around there at I don't know what speed, and it's a park. It should be for a space for people to enjoy. These things haven't gone off my list, but it's like, well, should I still be pushing that and not having delivered anything else in the meantime? And my conclusion was, no, we need a pipeline of stuff. Let's get cracking. There's so much need for this infrastructure across the city. The emphasis should be on delivering it. And I think from my experience and over the last 4 years, some areas of the city have been really embraced this and have done from the outset. So you look at Waltham Forest or Hackney, Camden, but then other boroughs have been looking at that and seeing what's happening. And suddenly saying, well, actually, no, we want that. You look at the changes that have been happening in Hounslow or Greenwich, or, I could think of all sorts of boroughs across in Southwark. There are all these changes happening, but suddenly other boroughs are thinking, actually, no, we want some of that. Our residents want to be safe. Our kids, we want our kids to be able to walk to school safely. And I think that, the more we deliver, the more appetite there is for more, because other people will say, well, they've got it, and it's not fair that we haven't.
So what you have done is kind of, TfL sent me a list of all of the routes that have been completed and the ones that are being completed, and it adds up to just over 100 kilometres. Are you kind of happy with what you've delivered in terms of the standards and the amount? Because it's been a heck of a busy time.
So the 100 kilometres, I think, is just what's been delivered in the last 12 months. That, we had tripled the amount of cycle routes. So, there were then 160 kilometres that we had before COVID of the protected lanes, but also the hundreds of kilometres of quieter streets through low traffic neighbourhoods, but also non-protected cycleways like some of the quiet ways that have been really enhanced during this. So there's been a huge amount that has been delivered. There's a huge amount more to deliver. So I think, We're doing the right stuff, and I think bringing in the quality criteria. So initially, when I inherited some of the programs from my predecessor, there weren't quality criteria for some of the schemes that were being delivered on borough roads. So, quite frankly, some of the quiet ways weren't quiet, and we all know that unless you've got good quality infrastructure, then people who are nervous or not cycling won't be attracted to fit. Unless they feel safe, they're not going to do it. And, for me, that was always, to take a term from my previous life, that was the market I was wanting to go after. It wasn't, we want to make existing cyclists safer. But what we really want to do is getting people who aren't cycling often or have got a bike in the shed or hanging on a balcony. And how do you bring those bikes out of hibernation and get those people to start using that to get around the city? And to do that, you need safety. And putting in infrastructure without those quality criteria, without having that ability to say, no, look, if that isn't good enough, we're not paying for it, then you're not going to get those people on their bikes and being able to enjoy the benefits that people get from pottering about the city on their bikes.
A lot of people listening to this will perhaps think that you're the Cycling and Walking Commissioner for London. It's totally in your gift to create a London cycle network. And some of our listeners will also know that that's not the case. There are 32 boroughs, and they don't always do what's needed. Some of them are great. Some of them don't do very much. Your job role, therefore, could you explain a little bit about how you go about it? Is it a form of, the politics of compromise? Is it about I think people used to say about Andrew Gilligan, he used to sort of go in and say, we're doing this kind of, get with the program kind of thing. How do you approach it, and how does it work in practice, and how difficult is it trying to get 32 different individually politically controlled boroughs to build up a London cycling network?
I think that's the key challenge of the job, and I think that's why it's so important that we London does have someone who's tasked to do that. You know, we have the boroughs, but there are other highway authorities. I've never heard of the Crown Estates Paving Commission, who are responsible for the roads in Regent Park.
Nobody has.
Well, I hope they have now. But you know, as working for the mayor, we've got 5% of London's roads are controlled. The highway authority of TfL for 5% of London's roads. 95% of London roads aren't, and so therefore, working with the boroughs, who are the main highway authorities for the rest of that, is an absolute essential part of this role. And you can't just stand and shout at people until they do as you're told, because eventually they stop listening to you. You know, if anyone's got children who's listening, standing and shouting at your kids isn't. You know, there are other things you need to do to try and to persuade people and influence people and cajole people. Part of that is about rewarding and publicizing great stuff, telling those really positive stories about what happens when you do to make some of those changes. And I think that part of my role is doing that. It's celebrating success, not just because we want to blow our own trumpets, but it's about actually saying, well, this is what's possible, you know. And as I said, when people see what's happening in some parts of London, they go, well, that's not fair. Why can they cycle safely? As I said, why can those people get to the shops without having to, you know, risk their lives crossing some dangerous roads? Why are their kids cycling or scooting to school? Why can't my kids do that? So that telling those stories of success, tracking the data is part of that. Showcasing where things are not working, I think, is part of that too. So, you know, I look at Kensington and Chelsea as a borough at the moment that I would say is not working and is not delivering safer streets for its residents. There is an awful lot, you know, there are powers that we do have. There's finances that we do have and how we control that investment. Like say, you know, I said before, I'd much rather invest the money in boroughs which are doing good stuff and sort of constantly trying to, you know, and hence having the quality criteria, because you don't want to spend money on things that aren't good enough. But there's also a lot of sort of personal interactions, knowing people, there's compromise, there's negotiation, there is that, you know, it's the same with anything in life. You know, if you want to try and to persuade, cajole, influence people to do things that maybe they're, you know, a bit skeptical of, you've got to make the case, you've got to argue, you've got to, you know, well, maybe if we don't do that, we could do this. And, you know, for me, the benefit, you know, I don't want to be too ideological. I'm a pragmatist on this. I don't think we can deliver the stuff that we can in London without taking a pragmatic approach. And what I've found is that once people do start delivering, then they go back and actually, we can do this. People do like this. This is not a threat to me at the election. You know, actually, my vote percentage has gone up. And then you say to another politician, well, look at that. They had some challenges here and here, but actually, number of people who voted for them have gone up, or they're popular, you know, or people are calling out for this now in these boroughs. So there's a whole, you can't just take one tool to change this. It's a whole range. And I think that's why it's so important that whether it be me or anyone else, that cities have someone who is responsible for this, who is championing it, who is accountable for it as well to the people in power.
I'm very conscious. We've had the last couple of episodes we've recorded, actually, we've interviewed representatives from both Wheels for Wellbeing and Transport for All.
Yeah.
Representing in slightly differing ways and to a different extent, but representing the kind of broad, very broad church that is the, in inverted commas, disabled community, or that voice. And I've been very struck by how unconscious I was of this entire, it required a paradigm shift from me as a non-disabled person to kind of get inside the head of this person who's speaking to me about the various problems that certain types of disability present, and really quite stridently bemoaning this sense that they feel quite often that their voice is only heard retrospectively and they're not part of the front end of this process sometimes. Are you satisfied? And I'm really not asking this with any agenda, simply as an open question. Are you satisfied that TfL and the work that you've done has always represented that as fully as it could have done?
Anyone who knows me will say, actually, Will's never satisfied with anything. And I think there's always room to do more. Yeah, I think, you know, a key part of our approach has to be that the benefits of active travel, which are, you know, you can list forever, but the benefits of active travel have to be available for all Londoners. And it's important that we maximize those benefits for everyone, including people with disabilities. Now, you know, I, like you, I wasn't aware of some of the challenges. I've been out, actually going out with Wheels for Wellbeing was particularly insightful for me to actually understand what it's like to cycle on some of the cycle routes using adaptive tricycles, adaptive cycles, and understanding, you know, simple things like, well, what a camber feels like when you're riding a bike with different number of wheels, which I hadn't experienced before. But it's, I think, you know, different types of different disabilities mean that different interventions and different schemes affect people in different ways. So, you know, what might be good for one set group of people with disabilities, like some of the benefits of low traffic neighborhoods can be good for people with, you know, neurological disabilities, but can be challenging for people with other disabilities. And so how we get that in the round is important. I, you know, like you, I speak to a lot of different groups and different sort of people with, you know, disabled community, but also across the board. And I think everybody's agreed on one thing, that the status quo is not what's desirable here. And we do need to make change, but we do need to do more to engage people from the outset in that design process. I think, you know, the last year, the pace and scale of street space and the lack of engagement that came with that through the government directives have caused a particular problem that some of the changes that were happening on people's streets quite simply were a surprise. And I think that's something I'm glad that guidance has changed, and I'm glad that isn't no longer the case. So I do think we need to do more on our engagement process, and that needs to be not just at the end of the process, but during the process. I think we need to make this dirty. But it's also, I think it is worth noting that particularly on disabilities, that, you know, 81% of disabled people every week, you know, walk at least once a week. 58% of disabled people use the bus at least once a week. The same percentage of disabled people cycle as use taxis once a week, you know. So we've got to make sure that actually we're making the space safer for everybody, suitable for everybody, and allowing people to get those benefits of active travel, even if they have got a disability or that they don't feel comfortable. And I think, you know, one of the things I'd like to do is actually do more to sort of help, you know, to do more to listen and to engage with people at an earlier stage.
The other thing, so the role, we had our podcast reviewed and I by somebody quite recently, Will, and they came up with a great phrase that we have a journalist, that's Laura, an advocate, that's Adam, and I'm apparently the devil's advocate. I think I only play that role simply because I'm horrendously ill-informed and I'm always asking the sort of like outsider numpty question, really.
Well, that's the best question to ask.
Well, sometimes it can be. Sometimes they can just be stupid, and this is probably going to be one of those occasions. Will, but
this is setting me up as a horrendously complicated question.
No, what you don't understand is I'm setting myself up here. What I've learned actually over the course of the last year since we've been doing this podcast, and it's been a bit of a light bulb moment for me, is that I came to this whole debate as an urban cyclist. You know, that's weirdly, I used to think I was Bradley Wiggins. I was one of those kind of lycra clad people who will ride very expensive bikes. And, you know, and bit by bit, I've kind of just slowed down and detoxified and I, you know, don't even wear lycra anymore. And I'm totally wedded to that way of life. I've just come off a block of 8 days where I've ridden every day into an absolutely howling headwind, by the way, from Lewisham to Ealing. To go and commentate on a bike race and then back home again. And it's been brutal, to be honest, but I still really enjoyed it. That's my everyday lived experience. I am that London, you know, cyclist that you're after, really, that you're trying to promote. I'm he. But here's the but. I've, over the course of the last year, I've suddenly realized that, you know, for every person on a bike, there are 200 who are walking, right? At any given time. I don't know. I've plucked that figure out of thin air, but it's a big number, right? And now I'm noticing that for every person on a bike, there's probably someone on a scooter. And I'm wondering whether actually concentrating, focusing all our efforts on me and the bike is only a very partial picture of what needs to change. And I'm wondering whether things like electric scooters are going to change your job completely in the years to come, because it seems to be happening very fast.
I'd agree with you, Ned. If I spent all my time catering for the likes of you, I would not be doing my job properly. I couldn't agree more. One, as I said before, we have to make our streets safer for people who are cycling at the moment. But the big challenge and the thing that the future of the city depends on is that in terms of cycling, it's getting people who aren't cycling to cycle more. And, you know, we know that there are millions of journeys that can be done by bike, but not every journey can. We know that. And this isn't an anti-car agenda, but only one half of my job is cycling, and everybody tends to fixate on the cycling because I don't know why. It seems, you know, I think it's a more organized sector. People identify it, but I think ultimately because everybody walks or wheels part of their journey. And so if I was only doing that, then if I was only doing the cycling, it wouldn't have taken account. And that's why I think at the very heart of, you know, I don't have a cycling budget. What I have is a healthy streets budget, and that is making our streets better for walking and cycling. And if you look at the indicators and the quality criteria and what we do on that, those include, you know, making our streets easier to cross. Does it have shade and shelter for people? Is it too noisy? Do people feel safe? Are there things to do? Do people feel relaxed? Has it got clean air? Those are the things that will encourage people to and enable more people to be active. So it's not just the cycling; it is the walking. And I take the walking aspect very seriously. It just seems that most journalists don't want to talk about it. They like to talk on the cycling because often it's quite controversial, and you talk about saying the word cyclist in some areas is like holding a red rag up to the book, it creates noise and attention and controversy. But walking, I think, is one of the most important things that all of us can do to improve our health and improve our city. And there are, of course, new technologies coming along. You know, every time I look at my kids' Christmas list, there's some new gadget, whether it's an electric scooter or a hoverboard or some new thing, newfangled gadget that is coming. But clearly, electric scooters are going to be part of our sort of urban transport system. I don't know if you know, but the government are trialing some e-scooter trials in different cities around the country. London is in the process of working through that trial, and hopefully that will be coming out soon. My own personal view on electric scooters is that you can't. I think that they present challenges. They present challenges to a lot of different groups. But they also present opportunities. They're not a panacea that some advocates would argue for, and they're certainly not the horrendous threat that other people would say. I do have some concerns. I worry about at the moment, there is no... do shut me off if I'm babbling on too much about this, but electric scooters, if there is... You know, I do have some concerns that one is that there is very little regulation on the vehicle standards. So what speed they can do. I saw a bloke, I was at the traffic lights going up Tower Hill, and a guy shot off on it. He told me he could do 50 miles an hour on his electric scooter. Yeah.
And, oh my God, I think I've seen those.
I looked it up afterwards. Yeah. It's astonishing. That's not safe. Some of them have got brakes in different places. Some of them haven't got front and back brakes. Some of them have got lights. Some of them don't. What size should the wheels be? All of that sort of stuff that regulate a sort of a vehicle needs to be in place for scooters. The second piece is that where should they go? And they shouldn't go on pavements. I worry about them going on pavements for people who walk, people who've got mobility issues, people pushing pushchairs, people walking their dogs, people walking with kids. You know, they shouldn't be on pavement. Absolutely not. And the third piece is actually about how cities can regulate the number of the scooters. So particularly with rental e-scooters, if you look at some other cities around the world, there have been thousands of them sort of suddenly deposited on this. And we had a little foretaste of that with the dockless bikes a few years ago that sort of didn't actually work out from a business proposition for most of them. But for the electric scooters, what we don't want are thousands of them suddenly, you know, tens of thousands of scooters cluttering up central London, parked all over the place. So there needs to be the power for cities to regulate how many they're in the city and how they operate.
But will we're talking slightly different things. We are going down an e-scooter cul-de-sac here, admittedly. But like I say, like you agree, I think they're really significant and happening fast. But there's two things, isn't there? There's the rental schemes.
Yeah.
Like Lime or whatever that London are obviously about to trial. But I think far more significant than that are the little tiny ones that you just buy from the shop down the road. It costs a couple of hundred quid because they're game changing, aren't they? The big hire ones are quite cumbersome, lumpy, big bits of kit that you can't just fold in two and take onto a bus or take with you down onto the tube or take into your office. But these little e-scooters, which do the job pretty effectively as far as I can make out, that's the future, I think.
So it depends what define do the job, because they can be good at some things, yeah. But my point is that electric scooters don't provide; they're not active transport, yeah. That you're standing on the thing, you're not getting the same level of activity as an e-assist bike or a bike or by walking, yeah. So while I would say that they are better than cars in terms of an urban transport option, they are not as good as cycling, and they are not as good as walking, and they're not as good as e-bikes, because you don't get all the benefits of those in terms of the physical activity benefits that we know are actually critical for health, mental and well-being. They're also not as environmentally friendly. So I think they are part of the solution for urban areas, but they are not be all and end all. And I think that's why, you know, from my perspective, we need to get the legislation right. The government do need to look at how you regulate them, where they go, the speeds, all the things I just talked about, because essentially we need to make them as safe as possible on our roads.
I'm sorry, I'm hogging it now. But I totally agree with you, Will. And I'm no fan of them particularly. I take on board all your reservations about their green credentials. I think they are a little bit unsafe looking. My point is, though, they're popular. They're really popular. They're getting very popular very fast. And they are fundamentally, the point is they're accessing a hard to access group of the population who you can bang on about getting on a bike. They're not going to do it. But a scooter appeals to them.
Well, they may do it if a scooter might be the bridge from doing nothing and using a car, using a scooter, then realizing bikes are better than scooters.
But I agree. I agree with all of that. But certainly that's why they need to be made safe. You can't have these things that can do 50 miles an hour. Like, that's insane for a vehicle like that to not regulate whether they've got front or back brakes. That's insane. You know, that's why we need to be able to make this safe. And particularly, you know, for certain groups of the population that have got sort of various, you know, underrepresented groups that have got disadvantages in terms of health or road danger outcomes anyway. And if that's what they're, going for something else more, it's on the government to make these things safe as possible. And that's what's lacking at the moment.
You mentioned, I'm a fan of e-scooters as well. They're we're not sponsored by an e-scooter company, though.
We'd be open to it.
Not yet.
Turns out we're not sponsored by anyone, actually.
No, we're not.
It's a request. Yes,
Will. Yes, it is. We're true amateurs. We're true amateurs in the best sense of the word. Unpaid. Doing it for the love of it.
One of the kind of things that's changed during your time as Walking and Cycling Commissioner, Will, is the budget, London's operational budget, Transport for London's operational budget has kind of disappeared from central government. Also, during the pandemic, you got a new couple of board members at TfL, and things have changed quite a lot. I'm wondering how you think things are going to sort of work going forward if Sadiq's re-elected, and presumably you'd stay on. Maybe you won't.
There's quite a lot in that question, Laura.
I know. I'm rolling them all into one.
TfL, for those people who aren't aware, is one of the few sort of major city transport authorities that's so dependent on fares, 70% of TfL's funding. And we're talking, this is a £10 billion a year business that runs the transport in the city, is funded through fares, and income associated with fares, like advertising and that sort of thing. And obviously during COVID, when, the tube journey shrank to 5%, I think at one point we're operating at 5% of the normal ridership, that has a catastrophic effect on finances. Because of that, we had a government bailout. We've had two government bailouts, actually, in terms of support packages to keep transport system running. And the investment for our cycling infrastructure comes through the TfL finances. And so obviously this has had a big impact on my work and I suppose on everything that's going on within the city. I think the good news is that the mayor and the prime minister might not see eye to eye on everything or a lot, but the one thing they do both enjoy and both value and both recognize the importance of is active travel. So, you know, both of them cycle around the city, but both of them, I think, you know, truly believe that the future of our cities is based on more active travel and more sustainable forms of travel, which is, this is good news because actually the funding packages that and the support packages that have come through TfL have all included a budget for continuing to invest in our active transport infrastructure, make our roads safer and enable more people to walk and cycle. You know, all of these things, you know, with more government funding becomes more government involvement. But as I said, because we actually, you know, we both agree on what needs to happen. And we both, it's an area of agreement. And therefore, we do work together to try and deliver that. So throughout this period, I've worked with Department for Transport colleagues, Number 10 colleagues, DfT colleagues, Borough colleagues, to deliver the transformation that's going on. And it comes back to, you know, we share the same goals, we work together to deliver it. You know, as you said, there's an election coming up. The mayor's up for re-election on the 6th of May. I hope everybody's registered to vote. But it is, and the outcomes of that will depend on, will sort of depend on, on my future. And I very much hope that I am still in post, because while I think we've delivered a huge amount for London and we've seen a record growth in the number of people cycling, we've seen record growth in, you know, every Monday I get an email from the Santander Cycle Hire team, who seems like every Monday they send me another thing saying we've broken this record, or that at one point the guys who do the cycle monitoring at TfL, we couldn't believe the data they were getting. So since
they thought something was broken.
They thought the system had broken, you know, but it's been this massive record outcome. But while we have achieved a lot, we've got so much further to go. You know, you go and look at some of the other cities around the world, like Amsterdam and Copenhagen, that are far, you know, been doing this for much longer. We are leading as a big city anywhere in the world, but we have got such a long way to go. And for me, that is about enabling all Londoners to be able to make the choice to walk and cycle. This is not saying everybody should walk and cycle. This is a simple choice. Do they have somewhere where they can feel safe to get around without causing air pollution, without creating climate change gases, and without putting themselves in harm's way? And that's why we need to make sure that we've got a safe cycle network.
In terms of things that you need to do well if Sadiq Khan is re-elected going forward, one of the things that, you know, I've noticed as somebody who walks and cycles in London frequently, although I don't live there, is it is the disparity. And I wonder, there's a deeper question here of TfL as an organization. Obviously you're representing active travel's agenda, and that's going higher up in TfL. TfL is still a massive organization, and I used to cross the Euston Road every day, which is a red route and controlled by TfL. And there are lots of these red routes across London. They're often very congested. I know that you're doing some work on red routes to make them, you know, cycle friendly. But largely, the KPI there, I believe, is the key performance indicator is traffic flow a lot of the time. Is that changing? And I noted there was a question, I think it was from Caroline Russell, the other week, you know, pointing out that there are still around 150 areas, crossings which don't exist, basically, which don't have a green man signal on red routes. And I used to cross the Euston Road every day. You've done that now. You've made crossings on the Euston Road for pedestrians, but you used to just have to run. And that sort of seems a bit backwards for a world-class city. So I just wonder what your plan is with red routes, because it's not that straightforward. You know, they are arterial routes, aren't they, as you'll know. So how do we solve a problem about these main roads, which so many opponents of things like low traffic neighbourhoods constantly discuss. And I think possibly some of the time they might have a point, because a lot of these ones don't have cycle facilities potentially.
So I don't think there's a single solution to every road. I don't think you can have, right, this is our plan for every one of these roads, and this is the sort of an ideological approach to this. You've got to look at each road in and each and how it works within an area on it in its own right. I'm a huge fan of some of the quieter routes for cycle routes. I think Quietway 2 that runs from Waltham Forest into the centre of town works really well. It's well used. We've had a huge increase in cycling. When things are done well, it's direct. It works. You don't need to say every red route needs a cycle route, and neither you need to say every back route needs to be filtered. You know, you need to look at, well, what are you actually trying to achieve? There are routes which you can't, you know, there are routes which are, you know, you can't, if you take the golden, you know, you need the cycle routes to be safe and direct. Yeah, that's the two things you need from a cycle route. And if you can't get it direct on other roads, then maybe you do need to look at some of those big arterial routes. But we've got to also recognise that for our city to work, we need to actually make sure that essential freight can get around, our bus service can operate, or a raft of other things. So there's no hard and fast rule for of what exactly we do on every red route. And, you know, there's also, it comes back to the point around the traffic authorities, that red routes pass through borough roads too. And different boroughs have different views themselves. So the notoriously most difficult bits of any sort of route to sort out or areas sort out are where boroughs are next to each other. And you've got a sort of TfL roll in together, because suddenly you've got, there's one road, the Bulls Pond Road is in on the border between Islington and Hackney. Yeah. And the north section of that road is in one borough of Highway Authority. So the white line in the middle of the road is the dividing lane, and the south side is the other part. And we've tried to put in 150 metres of safe cycle route to connect up Cycle Super Highway 1 going north-south, and that's taken... Well, it was my predecessor tried to do that, and we've actually finally managed to deliver it. But the challenges associated with the different highway authorities, it makes this all very, very complicated. I do agree with you, though, on the pedestrian crossing piece and actually improving the facilities for pedestrians in London is an absolute priority. I think in the last 3 or 4 years, we've delivered something like 700 new pedestrian improved pedestrian crossings, 600 plus junctions improved. I think we've rescheduled sort of over 5,000 sets of traffic lights to improve the pedestrian crossing. Now, you know, clearly there's an awful lot more to do on this, but the idea that, you know, when you look at each cycle route, so they get called cycle routes, but the scheme that we had in to protect cyclists in Holland Park from Holland Park Avenue to Notting Hill Gate had 15 new pedestrian crossings on. Yeah. Yet that was opposed by KNC. That, you know, we are building these schemes into those routes. It's not just the cycling priority route, it is also those pedestrian crossings. Bishopsgate, I think, is another good example. You have four of the most dangerous junctions in the city along that route. And the scheme in Bishopsgate actually sort of so, you know, it made those junctions much safer. So, you know, it's about looking at each road in turn and making sure that it works for that road. One of the things I'm really keen to do is look at sort of shift a bit more from from route-based planning to area-based planning. So rather than sort of focusing too much on, well, whose road is this? Yeah. Actually, let's look at the whole area. What's everybody trying to achieve, and work together with those boroughs and TfL and other highway authorities to do that as an area based rather than necessarily a route based approach.
So there's been a lot of discussion on Kensington High Street. It's dominated some newspaper column inches. It's brought people from London together for and against it, and in fact, you know, against it from as far as Nigeria and Russia, in the petition that was put forward against it, which was questionable, to say the least. It is subject to a judicial review from a campaign group, and that has led to it being reassessed, of which the crunch meeting is going to happen imminently. What's what's it been like, Will, from what you can tell us behind the scenes, and what is it? Because from the outside, it just looks like Kensington and Chelsea just have a fundamental dislike towards people who want to ride bikes safely. That's what it looks like. Is that the case, or am I misreading it?
You're probably asking the wrong person there. I think that question should be directed to the elected members in Kensington and Chelsea. You know, I've worked really hard to try and work with the borough on two schemes now to deliver a safe cycle route across east-west across there, either that Notting Hill Gate and Holland Park Avenue or Kensington High Street. You know, we shouldn't forget the fact that these are really dangerous roads. Just last week, there was a cyclist who was hit in a collision on Notting Hill Gate, exactly where we had proposed the cycle lane to happen. Thankfully, I think the person has not been seriously injured, but the difference between being seriously injured and a much worse outcome can be centimetres or seconds. And that's why creating safe cycle infrastructure is so important. You know, there have been two fatalities on that route, but Kensington High Street is even more dangerous. It's the highest rate of cycling casualties on any main road in that borough, and it's significantly higher than the Greater London average. This is about providing a safe route for people to get to school, to get across to work, to go to the shops, to go to the hospitals. It's got the backing of all sorts of major institutions, from Imperial College onward. And what's really interesting, for each of those schemes, which the borough have said, which, you know, whether it's the cycle lanes on Kensington High Street or on Holland Park Avenue, then we've always had the knockback that, oh, the residents don't want this, or the residents are opposed to it, without really having any evidence. We've seen surveys, as you said, that have attracted responses from as far away as Cairo and Caracas. Actually, what do people themselves think in Kensington, Chelsea? So I asked that question, and we did a survey. We did a representative, independent survey, representative of the population, according to ethnic breakdown, in terms of age, in terms of income, in terms of scientifically, statistically valid representative sample. That showed that 70% of our residents in Kensington, Chelsea want safe cycle routes. Only 14% opposed that. It showed that 56% of people wanted the protected cycle lanes on Kensington, Chelsea, on Kensington High Street. Only 30% opposed it. 59% of residents want the council to introduce protected cycle routes on their main roads, whereas only 28% of people opposed it. So I do not understand what is happening at Kensington and Chelsea. Are they not listening to their residents? I honestly, you know, it is wrong not to have a safe cycle route across that borough. It is wrong that people's lives are being placed at risk because of the lack of those facilities, particularly when the number of people cycling in London is expanding very quickly, particularly when neighbouring boroughs are developing very good networks and creating those cycle routes. And so I go back to the point, you need to ask the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea those questions, not me, because it is their decision as the highway authority to not do these things. It is their decision as a highway authority to keep the levels of road danger that they've got. And for the life of me, I don't know why.
If on Wednesday the cabinet members and the leader decide not to enable safe cycling in Kensington and Chelsea on the Kensington High Street, will and has the mayor considered invoking his ability to take control of the roads? Obviously, he needs Secretary of State approval, which is complex and problematic politically. But is that must have been seriously discussed so far, because they're just not playing ball and it's putting Londoners' lives at risk.
So under the GLA Act, the mayor has got the authority to request highway authority of roads from boroughs, but that needs the consent of the borough. Which I think is where the stumbling block lies. And if that consent is not forthcoming, then it gets escalated to the Secretary of State for Transport. That's the process for that. You know, for me, I don't want to go seizing roads off people. I think that, you know, that creates all sorts of problems, and you need a, you know, there are all sorts of things associated with that. What I want is that for Royal Borough of Kensington Chelsea to recognise that they've made a mistake in taking that protective cycle lane out, and to reinstate it, and to work with us to make it work for everyone who lives in that area.
Thank you, Will. And I, as somebody who cycles in that area, who relies on that area, I'm not a resident, but I still need to get through that area safely, as do my staff. We all appreciate the work that's been done, and hopefully common sense will prevail.
Yeah, here. As I said, that was one of the roads I used on my last block of commuting to get across East West London. It's a nightmare. It seems genuinely terrifying.
Yeah.
I just avoided it, I must admit, and went on side streets, but kept getting lost.
It's difficult to do that in a direct route, though. There is just not an alternative route, and it comes back to the point I was making earlier that cycle lanes need to be safe and direct, because they're not direct. A lot of people won't use them, and therefore it just puts people at risk on the roads that aren't safe.
I got completely lost repeatedly every single day, but that was quite a happy circumstance, because I wasn't particularly pushed for time, and I discovered that Holland Park is actually a park. I thought it was just a tube station.
There's a nice park.
I had no
idea.
There.
Be careful
it's
what you
really
say.
Nice park, isn't
be
it?
Be careful what you say here, Ned. You might end up as like some sort of testimonial on the Kensington and Chelsea website saying Ned Bolting, cycling enthusiast, says these quiet roads are brilliant.
Nice to get lost in Kensington and Chelsea.
I love the park.
There's quite a hill. Holland Park is like, it's quite a hill at the top there. Yeah.
Tell you what, anyway. Going up that hill on a normal bike, you know, at 8-9 miles an hour, having a taxi or a bus behind you is not an enjoyable experience.
That's why we need the cycle lanes on there. Yeah. You know, you've got a four-wheel drive coming up behind you, and someone behaving aggressively. It really is quite unpleasant.
That was incidentally, a bit of a humble brag from Adam there about the speed that he was travelling uphill, 8-9 miles an hour.
Up to 8-9 miles an hour, no big deal.
Yeah. we'll let you go. Thank you very much for your time. More power to your arm. Good luck, and good luck with the election as well. Let's hope that by after May you're still in a job, and that you continue to do it with such passion, enthusiasm and effectiveness. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for your time.
Thanks ever so much, everyone.
Well, that was Will Norman, someone who I was meeting for the first time. I know, Adam, you know him very well. And obviously, Laura, you two go back years, don't you, with your journalistic endeavours.
I did the first interview with him when he became Walking and Cycling Commissioner. I went to a walking conference where he and Jeanette Sadiq Khan were there. So I got two interviews in one. And and I thought he might be too nice to do the job. And so it's been a running joke ever since.
Well, I suppose that there aren't many people who have that, are in a position like Will. I mean, is it, am I right in thinking it's just kind of Will and Chris Boardman in Manchester?
And Dame
Sarah Story.
This is Sheffield, isn't it?
Does
Sarah come with a similar amount of sort of political clout? I mean, is she in a position where she can achieve things and put bricks and mortar in place?
I think she's working on her, on the mandate. She seems to have this, it's a fairly new region, if you like. So often when that's the case, when you have these kind of devolved regions, it takes a little bit of working out like who does what, but there's certainly, like what she does and what she says is bang on. She seems to really have the support locally to do that. So, you know, I think that looks quite positive. And you also have Simon O'Brien, who is in Liverpool City region. He used to be in Hollyoaks,
Brookside.
Brookside, that's it, sorry. He used to be in Brookside, but that's not why he got the job. But he is a good local champion doing stuff there. And then also there is Lee Craigie. Have I said that right?
Scotland. Yeah,
there's Lee Craigie in Scotland.
Active Nation Commissioner for Scotland.
He's a commissioner for the whole country. And then, of course, there is going to be, because the Prime Minister said, there's going to be a cycling and walking commissioner for England as well at some point in the future when Active Travel England is formed. So I think, you know, as Will says, there needs to be more of them. And I think in many cases it can A walking and cycling commissioner can do a lot of things and say a lot of things that maybe a directly elected mayor or politician can't. So I think it can be really, really effective, as Will's showing and as Chris has shown and others have shown as well.
I've worked with Simon O'Brien.
Have you? Were you an extra in Brookside?
No, it's not that I wasn't concentrating on what you're saying, but I was also looking at Simon O'Brien's Wikipedia page just to check what soap opera he was in. He was in Brookside, so it Laura was right there. Played from the soap to launch in 1982 until 1987, when his character was killed off.
Oh.
In York. I don't know why that's relevant. He then acted in the British version of Fraggle Rock. Remember that?
Yes.
No? Yeah, Fraggle Rock? I can vaguely remember it. Anyway, but where our career paths crossed was he presented a short-lived football quiz show called Do I Not Know That on ITV Digital. And for the 10 months it existed, I too was employed as a football presenter on ITV Digital.
Ah, so there you go. Your colleague. He's a nice guy. He's quite fun.
Yeah, well, that was wholly irrelevant and took us off in a path that we didn't need to go, which suggests to me that we've probably had our time now and should draw this to a close.
Yeah.
In which case, I shall refer to my script, if I can find it, that Laura always sends us, because I like to say the exact right words in just signing off once again. You've been listening, as ever, to Streets Ahead. Do let us know what you think. Find us at Pod Streets Ahead, rate us, review us, and share the podcast with anyone, particularly a potential sponsor who you might think would enjoy it. And from Adam, Laura, and myself, catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.